specter is haunting the world.
The specter of communism.
This is Dante here from the Spectre podcast of the Communist Party USA. And today we have a special guest with us, a Communist Party co-chair, Joe Sims.
Good morning, Dante. Hope you're doing good. Hi, everybody. I'm Joe Sims. I live in New York City. I'm 62. And as Dante said, I was elected co-chair of the party last June at our 31st convention, along with Rosana Cambron. Rosana lives in Los Angeles.
I think we should let our audience know, Joe, about your history and ties to the labor movements, your ties to the party, and your ties to the struggle against racism. So if you can give some background before we dive into the main thrust of our conversation, that'll be great.
I was kind of born into the labor movement. My dad was a steel worker. My grandma on my dad's side was married to a steel worker. My mom's parents were garment workers here in New York City. So, you know, that kind of background is in my blood. My mom and dad were both labor activists. He and the Steel Workers Union, she and AFSCME. At various points, they were involved in the NAACP. They were active in setting up African-American history study circles back in the day. In fact, my mom and dad met in the 50s in a fight to desegregate the swimming pools in Youngstown, Ohio. That was kind of led by a coalition set up by the Progressive Party that was still in existence at that time. And I remember them telling me that they had to fight their way physically in and out of the pool. My dad was a boxer back in the day, and I guess my mom admired his left hook. In any event, whether that's true or not, I got involved in the youth movement, the communist youth movement back then, joined the YWLL. That's an acronym for the Young Workers Liberation League when I was 15, 14, something like that. I was active in college, struggles, whether it was financial aid or the issue of affirmative action for Black and Latino students, or we had a big anti-apartheid divestment movement on my campus, and so on. Well, over the years, you know, I've worked in our movement in different capacities. I was involved in the World Federation of Democratic Youth back in the day. I served in its bureau for a couple of years. I was active in the World Youth Festival movement, I went to three festivals, actually four. The Berlin Festival, Moscow Festival, the festival in Korea. And then not so long ago, there was a festival in South Africa hosted by the youth wing of the African National Congress. But the last one I went to as a guest, as a veteran of the festival movement. Anyway, so I worked for the party in a number of capacities. I edited its theoretical journal for many years, worked as an editor of People's World, and like you said, I was elected a co-chair at the last convention. So that's a brief biography.
Awesome. There's been a question among youth currently, like millennials and Zoomers or Gen Z, about our current party's struggles against racism. There seems to be a romance type or romanticizing period of the 30s, and everyone thinks that we just like disappeared and stopped fighting against racism in this party. But I kind of want to frame this interview first starting off with current and modern struggles against racism, not particularly party related, but kind of what's happening internationally and also nationally within the U.S. framework. what's happening in the struggle against racism and Black liberation movements, and kind of what your thought and what your sense is of what's happening currently. And this could include struggles in the movement for Black Lives, Black Lives Matter, the struggle against police brutality, which a lot of youth, including myself, have suffered from in this country. So I'm just kind of want to frame the beginning of this conversation of what's kind of happening now within the U.S. and also internationally in the struggle against racism, and then kind of tie this back into what the party's involved with currently.
Well, it's a good question, Dante. And I think our point of departure has to be what's going on now with this coronavirus issue. Because of our life circumstances, people of color, African Americans in particular, are going to be the greatest victims of it. We have the least means available to us because of our economic situation, are going to be among the most affected by it. I just saw a piece in the, publication it was, that said that the majority of people working today are Black and brown, you know. We are on the front lines of the fight against this virus, whether, you know, it's nurses or doctors or nurses' aides or people working in nursing homes, whatever it might be, to people who are, you know, working in grocery stores or at McDonald's or Burger King or wherever they might be employed. And so I think from that standpoint, demands that have to be placed before the government and this administration have to take into account our special needs and circumstances. And that includes what's happening with the prison population. You know, most, we have a majority of those who are incarcerated, and the mass democratic movement is already placing demands that during this crisis, we gotta see what's happening with those populations who are locked up, and take some measures to get them some relief, like, for example, giving an amnesty to nonviolent offenders, or addressing the circumstances of immigrants who are locked up and locked down and overcrowded circumstances. Or how about the issue of brothers and sisters who have been locked up 30, 40 years, but now senior citizens, giving an amnesty to them. So these are issues that in the midst of this crisis have to be addressed, and they have to be addressed now. Racism and oppression don't affect everybody equally. You know, there are degrees of because of the way racism is organized. We live in circumstances in which there is a racial social division of labor. And so different people are affected differently. And each of us, each group, that is, we need to take into account special compensatory measures to address those problems. Taking a step back from the immediate crisis, as you indicated, the fight against racism is wide-ranging. It ranges from the criminal justice system, the fight against police violence and murder, to the issue of voter suppression, which is an ongoing problem with respect to the participation of Black folk in the political and electoral process, because the Republican Party is always attempting to reduce our vote by whatever means they can do it. And so addressing that is a big issue for our people's movement. And the issue is how to address it so that it can be permanently done away with. I think that finding more permanent solutions to these problems is the one of the big issues that is in front of us, because not only do we got to deal with the issue of voter suppression, we also have to address the issues with respect to the general participation of our people in the economic and social life of our country. And in that respect, since the 1970s, the country has taken a major step backwards. Mm-hmm. For example, there are less African-American students enrolled in colleges and universities across the country. And when you go to the issue of graduate schools, there are even less. And that's because affirmative action measures have been either watered down or done away with, mm-hmm. you know? The same thing is true with respect to industry. One of the things that happened prior to the dismantling of basic industry in this country was that there were a number of affirmative action measures that were put in place to raise the amount of African Americans who were employed in more skilled trades. But when the industries disappeared, those measures disappeared. So finding solutions to these kinds of problems is a major, major issue. In general, Dante, I would say that the civil rights, the freedom movement for our people, while very involved and making, I think, enormous strides, has suffered from an inability to connect political, legal struggles from economic and social struggles. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So that the underlying economic problems that are the basis for racism have not been addressed. And so therefore, Black workers make, 70 cents to the every dollar that a white worker makes, mm-hmm. you know, which is a basis for super profits for corporations. Ending that racist wage gap is an ongoing issue that actually is not being addressed. But if you want to move in the direction of real equality, you got to address the underlying economic circumstances that are the foundation of it. And so I think that addressing that issue is something that needs to be brought to the forefront in the fight against racism. And it's something that currently no one is talking about in a systematic way.
Yeah, so what you're getting at is that the whole social economic foundation of this country, which is tied to the hyper-capitalist economic system that we live in, is the reason for the exploitation of Black workers and Black people in general. And I think it was mentioned in a recent article on the party website that, or referenced in the recent article about this book, Black Marxism, that the late scholar Cedric Robinson wrote about, talked about like the racial character of capitalism and why people need to while these struggles are separate, they're also very intertwined with each other, and we need to fight each extremely hard. So I guess the overarching question is, why socialism for Black people, or why should we start thinking in a anti-capitalist framework? And along with that, can you also touch on some of the party's history of our involvements in these previous decades in these struggles, which are anti-capitalist and also anti-racist in there?
Well, with regard to the first part of your question, and it kind of relates to what we were talking about before, you know, why is socialism a solution? Because capitalism engendered our oppression. Capitalism is the cause of our oppression. Capitalism cannot be the solution to our oppression. Dante, do you know that I was talking about the racist wage gap?
Mm-hmm.
The only place in the economy where Black folk have been able to come close to whites in the wages paid is in the public sector,
mm-hmm.
you know, which, by the way, is the largest employer of our people, public sector, you know. And that's why the Republican Party has been working as hard as they possibly can to attack public workers' unions in order to reduce the political and economic status and power of the African-American community and the unions that are representing them. And so if you understand that the public sector is the place in the general economy where our people have been able to move forward, it gives you a sense of the importance of bringing about public solutions to our problems. Capitalism has historically rested on racism, because when we talk about racism, we're talking about something that's more than an idea in a bigot's head. You know, we're talking about a system of racist practices. We're talking about institutionalized racism that manifests itself in every single aspect of our lives. It manifests itself in the criminal justice system. It manifests itself in healthcare. It manifests itself in housing, in education, in the military, in you name it, racism is a part of it. And that's because this country was built on racist foundations. Slavery, Marx said, provided the what he called the primitive accumulation of capital that allowed industrial and financial capitalism to be developed. It would not have happened but for the existence of chattel slavery and the trade of cotton for slaves in the transatlantic triangular trade. So this goes back to the very foundations of the Republic. And by the way, there's a huge debate taking place in the country with respect to that. Here I'm talking about the 1619 project that was undertaken by the New York Times, where academics like Gerald Horn and a number of others have made very important contributions to locating the racist foundations of the U.S. Republic. And it's extremely important to do that, because unless you understand how the country was founded, you can't address the problems that we're dealing with today. There is a direct line between 1619 and what's going on today. But you asked about the party's involvement in anti-racist struggles. Well, in that regard, I'm happy to and proud to say that our party has always understood that addressing racism is a necessary condition, not only for the Marxist movement, but for the labor movement in general, that if you wanted to organize working people successfully, that you had, because the class was multiracial, and it's always been, you know, Black, white, Asian, Black, white, Asian, Latino, that's always to varying degrees been the demographic characteristic of our class. If you wanted to unite it, you had to address the special problems that were being placed upon people of color. Even way back in the day when Karl Marx wrote Capital, he made the point that he was talking about the once again, slavery. He said, labor in the white skin cannot be free so long as labor in the black skin is branded. But the socialist movement did not always understand this issue, you know? And the Socialist Party, while making a lot of strides, argued that the problem of racism would be addressed with the socialist revolution, you know, that you didn't need, therefore, to fight specific battles against racism before the revolution occurred. It was all a big class battle. But the Communist Party, drawing its understanding from the lessons of other parties in other countries, understood, and this in particular from Lenin, that unless you took up the problems of what we call racial and national, that is, the discrimination against people based on race and nationality in the period before socialism, unless you address those problems, you would never get to socialism because the class would be divided. Mm-hmm. Black would not trust white. Asian would not trust Latino. And that disunity would make the socialist revolution impossible. And we've seen that play out time and time again. Mm-hmm. And so throughout our history, we have understood that we've got to put racial demands up front. And that goes back from the time of the fight in the South against segregation. You know, one of the big famous battles was the fight to free the Scottsboro defendants. It was an important issue in the issue to in the fight to found the industrial unions, both in auto and in steel and in electric, because the bosses were bringing in black and brown labor to break strikes and all of that kind of thing. So the white workers had to understand that they needed to address black folks' special problems if they were going to, you know, even be able to organize a union. And it extends through today. So in almost every battle, whether it was against segregation or whether it was to found the industrial unions, or if it was in the 1960s and 50s in the battles for voting rights, or if it was in the fight for against apartheid in the 70s and 80s, or if it is in today's ongoing fight for black lives and against police violence, our party has taken the position that the special issues that I've been describing have to be placed at the forefront of these democratic and class battles.
Awesome. You said a lot of terms throughout that whole conversation, so I think it's fair to our audience that we define some of these terms before we dive even further in some of this history that we've discussed partially. So I think we want to start off with, what do we mean by this like special oppression or like the national question for nations or races, for example, as well? There's some other terms that have been also thrown around throughout the movement, such as like centrality of racism, racial capitalism, which was a term turned by Cedric Robinson. What do we mean by African-American equality, which you already tied into a little bit in the previous question? And what do we mean by also like white chauvinism? And then theoretical framework as a Marxist-Leninist, how do we look at the struggle against racism?
Well, you put a lot on the table. You know, when we talk about oppression, we have to understand that we can't be narrow in our approach to Marxism, because oppression takes many different forms. You know, there's class oppression, you know, which means that there's exploitation of labor at the point of production. Workers are exploited, meaning that they're not paid equal to the amount of value that they produce in the course of a working day, you know. That's economic exploitation in Marxist terms. But there's more than that, you know? I mean, there's gender oppression, you know? Oppression of women. There's the oppression of LGBTQ people because of their sexual orientation. And there is also oppression against people of color. And that oppression against people of color takes the form of both racial oppression based on a person's looks, physical characteristics, you know, the texture of their hair, the color of their skin, the shape of their nose, the thickness of their lips, on the one hand, and nationality, that is to say, their culture, place of origin, on the other. And here's the important thing, Dante. In each of these forms of oppression, separate from class, they affect entire categories of people, right? So, for example, women are oppressed as women. You know, all women are subject to sexism. We're seeing that today in the Me Too movement. Male supremacy is practiced by, to one degree or another, sadly, by all men. And all women are affected by it. So in that sense, it's an all-class issue. You feel me? It's an all-class issue. Women are oppressed no matter, as women, no matter if they're rich or poor. The degree of it varies, but, you know, they suffer from it. Well, the same thing is true for issues with respect to race and nationality. They are all-class issues. African-Americans are oppressed. We are oppressed as a people. Well, let me give you an example. There's a phrase that we use in our communities to describe what happens to us when driving. It's called driving while black, you know? We are stereotyped by police departments. We are criminalized. They have an image of us that, as a people, that we are criminals. So therefore, when you're on the highway, you get pulled over and stopped, you know? And the darker you are, the more likely you are that you're going to be, you know, pulled over and harassed by the police department, you know? So in this sense, we are, no matter what you what your status in life is, you are a victim in American style capitalism of racial and national oppression. And because of this all-class victimization, we say that the struggle, because we are oppressed as a people, for equality is a, that the main form of our struggle, rather, is a struggle for equal rights, you know, because all black people are oppressed to one degree or another. And our goal in that respect is to be treated equally with all people in this country, and most importantly, with all white people. And so we talk about the right to equality. And when you talk about rights, you know, you're talking about democracy, right? So the in that sense, we argue that the struggle for equality in its general form is a democratic struggle, right, for equal rights. And whether that took the form back in the day, the way the issue was placed was the right of self-determination. Again, you're talking about a right to self-determine, to auto-determine how you live, where you live, who you live with, or whether it's the takes the form of today's fight for voting rights or the right not to be followed when you go to Macy's, or the right not to be pulled over by the police or the right not to be killed because of how you look, you're talking about a general democratic right.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, because there is, I use the term, a racial social division of labor, meaning that the racism, as I said earlier, is structured into the economy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it always has been. If we really want freedom, you got to combine a democratic fight with an economic fight, you know, and you have to twin those issues. And by the way, one of the things that happened in the course of the movement was that we had organizations back in the day that combined those struggles, you know. One of them was called the Civil Rights Congress,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was a left and center organization in the African-American community, you know, in which communists and socialists and Democrats, and I would imagine there were some Republicans and churches and community organizations all met together to advance the struggle for equality. But they said, they took the position that the issue of equality was both an economic and political issue, whereas the NAACP pursued the struggle for equality largely along legal lines. They mm-hmm. were fighting it in the courts, you know, whereas the Civil Rights Congress, some of the socialists, some of the communists were fighting it not only in the courts, as we did in the Scottsboro case, but also in the streets, also in the factories, also on the farms, and so on and so forth. So these terms that we use relate to the various struggles as they evolved historically. You asked about white chauvinism. Well, we don't use that term that much anymore. We basically talk about white supremacy
mm-hmm.
or white racism,
mm-hmm.
and we try to be even more specific and describe white racism as ruling class racism,
mm-hmm.
because the source of racism in the United States is the white Anglo-Saxon, largely rather,
mm-hmm.
Anglo-Saxon ruling class. And that's where it originates from, which, by the way, is very carefully hidden. So, you know, chauvinism is a French word, you know, kind of has a connotation to the national aspirations of a particular nationality. And in the course of the evolution of the American Republic, different nationalities of Europeans came to the United States, and a white identity was developed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a time when Italians weren't viewed as white,
mm-hmm.
or the Irish weren't viewed as white, or Jewish people weren't viewed as white. But in the course of the emergence, particularly in the 20th century, of the American nation, these groups were assimilated into that identity,
mm-hmm.
Which was connected with the emergence of the American Republic, the American nationality as it was conceived at that time, and the arrogance of that nationality took the form of white chauvinism.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that term ain't used that much anymore, and we generally substitute it with the concept of white supremacy. I guess the closest thing that comes to equaling the concept of white chauvinism would be the widespread use today of the term white nationalism, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Associated with the Trump presidency. And the fascist-like danger that is associated with it. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, no, that's perfect. To go way back, and this also is very tied to modern struggles, I really want to talk about like black nationalist currents within the U.S. And on top of that, if you can, describe what would one call like a reactionary version of black nationalism, and then what one would also call potentially revolutionary black nationalism. Because there seems to be a lot of discussion about this currently as well, and like discussions about fighting against racism today. And there's a lot of reactionary elements that have popped up over the past couple of years, particularly in black nationalist currents. And one example I'm thinking of is the internet phenomenon ADOS, hashtag ADOS, which stands for American Descendant of Slavery, but a lot of its founding members or activists, if you want to call them that, were very, very reactionary and actually supported Trump and a lot of white right-wing extremist ideas as well. And it's very along the lines of this like kind of separatist type framework. And then there's organizations or movements, particularly in the South currently, that you can draw a line to possibly the 1920s, but at least the new left period of like the 60s and 70s. There's this group, Cooperation Jackson, which we actually mentioned in our Books of the Decade, and it's built off of the Malcolm X grassroots movements, which is like a self-proclaimed revolutionary black nationalist grouping. And they actually had a lot of success of putting in some work in Jackson, Mississippi currently. And it's actually very inspiring for some black youth folks like myself.
Okay, well, you load up for bear, man. you know, nationalism, Dante, is a response to racism. It's a response to discrimination. Mm-hmm. It's a response to being treated like a dog, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. not being given any respect. You know, and an understanding that the strength of your humanity and looking for a way to express that. And you got to say that that's a positive thing, mm-hmm. you know. It's a positive thing to fight against oppression in whatever, you know, form it takes. So I'm not, and never have been, you know, mad at the nationalists. I'm mad at the racists, mad at racism, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's really important, you know, for us to, we need unity in our people, you know. If we're going to be able to unite with other peoples in a common fight against our common oppressors. That said, all things aren't, you know, equal, and not every response is the right response or a response which will resolve in successful struggle. And we're interested in being successful. We want to win, you know? Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, Dante, we have to win mm-hmm. because the issues have become so sharp that our existence on the planet, our very existence on the planet as a people, all people, is at stake. When you talk about, you know, some of the environmental issues that have come to the fore, you know, I think that it is important to understand. And so certain nationalist currents don't, at least in my opinion, always lead to successful outcomes, you know? And so what is the difference between reactionary nationalism and revolutionary nationalism? Well, I would say that they're basically, I don't want to be class reductionist, but I do think that one represents the interest of black capitalism you know, broadly speaking. And the other represents a more populist or working class interest. The revolutionary nationalism represents a more populist or working class. And you could see that, for example, the reactionary side of Black nationalism you mentioned in the works of Booker T. Washington, you know? Booker T. Washington pursued an assimilationist a policy, you know, that focused on developing Black businesses on the one hand, and he said, well, it really wasn't true, skilled trades on the other. I say it really wasn't true because, as Du Bois pointed out, when you looked at the actual curriculum of Tuskegee, they were not training people to become carpenters and bricklayers, but dishwashers and people who did white folks' laundry. But generally speaking, that was the outlook that, that Booker T. proposed. And he said, we will make concessions to white capital so long as you allow us our own separate independent development. And so at the Atlanta Cotton Exposition of 1895, he said, famously or infamously, we can be as separate as the five fingers, but one as the hands and all things beneficial to mutual progress. Mm-hmm. In other words, we accept segregation, boss man, so long as you allow us to, you know, and basically he meant me, allow me to assume leadership of this movement. Mm-hmm. And Morgan said, hell yeah. Rockefeller said, hell yeah. There were other examples of it, you know, some of them expressed themselves in the Nation of Islam, you know. And if you look at their political program, it is a basically a program that promotes, you know, Black capitalism and so on. Whereas the revolutionary nationalists, you know, one, I guess the most important figure of the 20th century that comes to mind is Malcolm X, but there were many others, had, as I said, a more people-oriented platform and a program. You know, one of the points of departure for the nationalist movement is we want land. We want our own land. Some of the groups that you described in your introduction to this question brought to mind, you know, many of them. And I would say that, you know, land is not necessarily a bad thing, but there's something that's more important. What is that? It's capital. Capital is more important, in my view, than land. And by capital, I mean the physical plant, you know, the factories, you know, the distribution mechanisms, you know, the trains and the ships and the railroads, you know, the internet, in addition to the money forms of capital, because without those things, you can't do nothing with the land. You understand what I'm saying? Without that capital, you can't do anything with the land. You know, you need capital in order to work the land. And then there's the forms of human capital, which is the skill, the educational and scientific and technological capacity of a people. So you need those forms of human labor capital as well in order to be so successful. And Dante, I think it's really important for us in our in the movement for the liberation of our people to be successful. We want to win. We have to win. And we need a united front in order to do that. We need a united front of our people. And so you got to ask yourself the question, what is the minimum platform around which we can agree? as a people that would unite communists and socialists and liberals and church people and revolutionary nationalists and conservative nationalists and what we used to call pork chop nationalists, you know, who cultural nationalists, mm-hmm. who have an emphasis on tradition, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, there's another, the nationalist, you know, current, you know, you can't reduce it to one particular thing. Mm-hmm. So here again, one of the streams of it was an emphasis on reclaiming our identity, which was stripped from us completely. Mm-hmm. Stripped. They took our name. They took our language. They took our religion. They took everything. And when they brought us here, and then they imposed their culture on us. And so one of the responses of the, and it's not just a nationalist response, it's a response of, if we want to claim who we are, you know? And so there was a search for an identity, a search for an African identity, because we were called Negroes, mm-hmm. you know, up until the midpoint of the 20th century. And then we demanded a change. We wanted to associate correctly ourselves with Africa. And we just described ourselves as African Americans. Well, some of the cultural nationalists, you know, took that to an extreme and attempted to locate our, the starting point for our freedom in a identification almost completely with, you know, what they thought were African traditions and culture and languages and so on and so forth. Which we can understand, but it by itself, again, will not take us where we want to go. And then there were debates about, can we find freedom here, you know, in the United States, or do we need to leave the country, right, mm-hmm. emigrate to Africa? And that debate has always been present. It was present in the 1900s, you know, when, like, in the 1830s and 1840s, the free blacks in the North got so frustrated with the white folks and the problem of slavery, they're developing an emigration movement. Du Bois talks about that. Frederick Douglass took a pretty strong issue with it. But it reemerged in the part of the last century in the Garvey movement, mm-hmm. Which was a huge a mass movement amongst black people in the United States and the Caribbean that had its aim of going back to Africa, you know. And here again, you know, these trends arise when we don't see progress in the fight against racism, you know? Mm-hmm. And so to the degree that white folks seriously engage and take initiative in fighting racism and fighting for unity, there's always an appreciation of allies amongst our people, amongst black people. But to the extent that that doesn't happen, and it hasn't happened nearly enough, it kind of feeds this separatist, go it alone, we don't have responsible allies kind of outlook. And you can understand the source of it. And again, if you take a look at the 1619 Project and the debates surrounding it, you can begin to appreciate some of these issues and the importance of the communist movement of intervening in it. Because, for example, the problem that I talked to you about the socialists not seeing race and identity as important issues, mm-hmm. well, back in the day, there were organizations in the Trotskyist movement who repeat that mistake today with respect to 1619, saying that it's a diversion to talk about racism. It takes away from a united class approach and all of that kind of foolishness. So the self-organization and self-movement of our people, on the other hand, has always had a democratic current. This was true in the Niagara Movement that was founded by W.E.B. Du Bois and Monroe Trotter and Ida B. Wells. Mm-hmm. And it was true with the NAACP in its origins. And it was true with the African Blood Brotherhood, which was a Marxist a group largely initiated by Black folk from the Caribbean in the Roaring Twenties, who later came into the Communist Party and served as a place for developing a revolutionary working class outlook amongst our people. You know, was a extremely historic contribution, because that is to say, a revolutionary working class outlook is a really important contribution. Because without that, you make a lot of mistakes in the course of trying to find your way to freedom. You run the risk of going down a lot of blind alleys. And so to reduce that is really important as much as possible. We have a huge tradition of struggle, you know, and experience in the North and the South and the Midwest to draw from, initiated by African Blood Brotherhood and the early cadres that came into the Communist Party through the Civil Rights Congress, through the NAACP, through, you know, organizations like SNCC and CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, through the Panthers, up through the Black Lives Movement today. So I don't know if that gets to where you wanted to go, but you certainly took me there.
Oh, no, that's perfect. Yeah, I was just mostly curious because a lot of Black youth today are looking for something that's revolutionary and speaks to Black people and such. Me personally, I was attracted to the party because of this history itself. And I think the party is like a revolutionary basis for a multiracial kind of united front to fight against capitalism and racism because of these intertwined struggles. And the fact that a lot of Black revolutionaries or Black communists that we know of or kind of been erased from history, but folks that are in the movement know of, like Angela Davis, Charlene Mitchell, yourself, Jarvis, Tyner, and then folks before them, like Claudia Jones and such. We're all attracted to the party for a particular reason. And I think it's important to talk about these things. On this discussion of kind of like the foundations of our involvement with, like, for one, Black nationalist type movements, but also taking that kind of anger against racism and turning it into a kind of revolutionary program, which was initially kind of in the African Blood Brotherhood with these immigrants from the Caribbean, and then eventually joined in with the Communist Party in the late 1910s. But I think the African Blood Brotherhood joined the CP in 1921. So I'm just curious for a historical analysis of what was our initial analysis on, like, racism and kind of the national question for Black people in this country. And I'm just curious, like, how was, like, the international communist movement involved since the Soviet Union was, I guess, just coming out of a civil war, and there was these, the Communist International, which was having these congresses, these meetings, and a lot of Black members in the party at that time were actually studying in the Soviet Union to pick up these concepts of Marxism-Leninism. And I'm curious of how that was kind of applied to the party out here in the U.S. and what kind of came out of that.
Right. Well, it's an important question, and there are many, many lessons to it, because what you're describing was the party's initial approach to what would it take for us to get freedom in the United States, you know? Mm-hmm. And there were always two directions that were not mutually exclusive, by the way, that were pursued. One was expressed in the concept of the struggle for full equality, wherever you were. and the other took the form of what was called the right to self-determination. And by the way, the Communist Party is still in favor of Black folks' right to determine our own future, to self-determine what we do. We've never challenged that. Mm-hmm. And if anybody tells you that we did, they don't know what we're talking. They're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We view the African American people as an independent people, and we view the African American movement as an independent movement. And I'll tell you something else, Dante. Even if we didn't, it wouldn't matter, because Black folk are going to do what Black folk are going to do, mm-hmm. no matter what somebody from outside says. You know what I mean? So there should be no question with respect to of that. However, that said, the concept of self-determination as it was practiced back in the day took the form of taking a political posture that we would find our freedom by means of setting up an independent nation in what was called the Black Belt in the South. And there were and probably still are, a group of counties that extended from Florida up through Virginia and Maryland, where they were majority Black populations, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was put forward that this constituted a nation, in Marxist terms, a nation that had the right to determine politically its own future by setting up a separate republic. And they defined, and we still define, nation in very specific terms. Lenin and Joe Stalin, who were the main thinkers who developed the concept, argued that there were like five conditions for being understood as a nation. What were they? I think there was a common territory, a common economy, a common language, common psychological makeup, so on and so forth. I think that's four. There's one more. And they looked at the African-American people in the South, and they argued that all of those conditions were met, and therefore we constitute a separate nation. And of course, let's understand that this was being argued when, A, we were predominantly in the South, and B, we were living in a situation of Jim Crow fascist-like segregation.
Mm-hmm.
But we couldn't go to the same store, we couldn't drink the same water, we couldn't live in the same, couldn't ride on the same bus, we just couldn't. We weren't allowed to. And so you can understand how that point of view evolved. But there's another thing that we have to understand, and that is that the experience then, and you're right to ask this question, was largely borrowed from the experience developed in Russia and the Russian Revolution, which was a hugely important event, is a hugely important event in world history because it changed the face of the map. And Russia, at the time, was referred to as the prison house of nations. I think there was like 109 different nationalities that were occupying in Asia and in Europe. In Eurasia, the land of the former Soviet Republic, you know,
mm-hmm.
there were Azerbaijanis and Uzbeks and Ukrainians and Poles and Russians and Mongolians and Lithuanians and Estonians and so on and so forth. And they were all oppressed by the great Russian nation, singular. And so Lenin argued that in the epoch of imperialism, that it was extremely important in the fight against imperialism that the working class movement align itself with these oppressed nationalities and nations who weren't allowed the right to develop equally, that were oppressed because of who they were. And so here again, the democratic right, which means that this struggle and its main features is a democratic struggle of people to determine what their future is going to be, is something that the communist movement must champion. And so in the discussions in the Third International, which was a grouping of communist and workers' parties, the American delegations in consultation with the communists from other countries, I think mechanically applied the Russian notion of how freedom was going to achieve self-determination to the United States. And therefore, our party made that argument. But here's the thing, Dante. Mm-hmm. As they were doing that, even before they were doing it, a revolution was taking place in the life circumstances of Black people. What was that revolution? Well, it was the Great Migration. There was big industrial development in the North. There was terrible oppression in the South. And so Black folk, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, moved, you know, from Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi, north and west, you know, North Carolina. That happened to my family. We're from Alabama. And so fleeing racism, we went first to Oklahoma, and then we went to Kentucky. Finally, we ended up in Michigan and in Ohio, in Detroit and in Youngstown. But that happened to, you know, hundreds of thousands of families. And so with that shift in population, the specific gravity, if you will, of the freedom movement changed dramatically. And that had a big impact on national politics. But there was another issue, and that is whether or not the conceptualization itself was not problematic. And W.E.B. Du Bois argued that it was. He wrote a piece in Paul Robeson's magazine, Freedom, I believe in 1951 and 1952, called 100 Years of Negro Freedom. And in it, he specifically goes point by point through those five categories of Marxist categories. Mm-hmm. By the way, Du Bois was, Dante, probably the world's greatest theoretician on the national question. I mean, you know, he was the founder of the Pan-African movement, mm-hmm. you know, one of the foremost articulators and activists in the freedom movement of all people of color. And so Du Bois, point by point, goes through, do we have a separate economic community? Do we have a common psychological makeup? Do we occupy a separate territory? And in each instance, he says no, you know? And then he says, well, maybe here, and maybe a little bit more there. But taken together, he argues that the main content of the freedom movement for our people at that time took the form of a working class people who faced racial and national discrimination, the solution to which was by forming an alliance with white labor, particularly in the South, he says, in the common fight against monopoly capital. And mind you, this is after the Second World War. It's at the height of the McCarthy period. It's while the NAACP is pursuing a legal struggle in Brown versus Board. And it's in a situation in which there are huge battles taking place to break the back of segregation. I told you the story about my mom and my dad. That happened in 1953. So when you talk about the self-determination piece, that is its history. And some people in the party continue to hold on to it, did not see the evolution of that change. Here's the point I'm trying to make, man. Like every other single issue. This is a struggle that is in motion constantly, you know. It's constantly changing. And you got to keep up with the changes as they're occurring in real time. Take Claudia Jones. You know, she wrote that very famous piece on the plight of Black women. And in it, she makes the point that in the 1940s, most Black women were employed in domestic labor, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in 2020, is that still the case? No, not at all. At least not very many African-American women. There are a large number of women who are immigrants who are now, you know, working in that capacity. But because of what happened in the 60s and 70s and 80s, with the shifts in the working class and the entry of women into the areas of mass employment in the country, the trajectory of African-American women changed very, very significantly, as did the situation faced by Black men, because at that time we were largely employed in basic industry, right? But then what happened, right? Industry collapsed, steel, auto, electric collapsed. And so now in 2020, you know who the major employer of Black men is? It's in driving trucks. Driving trucks. And by the way, that's not going to last long, because soon those trucks are going to be driven by computers,
right?
And we're going to lose all those jobs because of automation and artificial intelligence and so on and so forth. So here's the point I'm trying to make. The political economy of our struggle, if you will, as a people, that is, what we do. When I say political economy, I mean what we do in order to survive, how we earn our living, and where we earn it, and how we earn it, and our educational and level of skill, the number of people who have high school and college and PhDs and degrees, and so, these are all extremely important issues. Where do we live? How are we dispersed geographically around the country? All of these are very, very important issues when you think about how we're going to win our freedom. I'll end this by just indicating what happened in the South Carolina primary, where the Black vote, if you think about it, determined who was going to be the candidate, the Democratic candidate for the presidency, you know? So Black people in South Carolina, you know, did that. Of course, there were other factors that were involved, but mm-hmm. Black people in South Carolina did that. So, which is one expression of what we call the centrality of the African-American freedom movement. It's not the totality of it by any means, but it's one expression of it, because where you are located geographically has the potential of a big impact politically. And in many of these swing states, we as a people are the margin of difference with respect to who wins and who is defeated in congressional and presidential elections. And so issues of state power and governance are very much related to the African-American freedom movement.
Thank you for your time, and look forward to having a further discussion on this.
Thanks for inviting me. I enjoyed it. Yeah. And let's continue to kick it.
Awesome.
Next time.
Right. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Take care, Dante.